So it, this is more or less the title is on the this is more or less the title that's on the guide. So except it's modeling, not modelings, but you get the idea. The first again, I'll same structure as yesterday. I'll try and motivate this a little bit, just with a bit of background. It's more or less the same background as I talked about yesterday, so we can get through that quickly. And then I'll talk a bit about prosody models and the prosody model that we use at the lab. And then I'll talk a bit about what you can do with prosody models. To begin with, the stuff I talked about yesterday was more or less my stuff. This isn't. This is funded by the Swiss National Science Foundation to fund Pierre-Edouard working at IDIAP. And also on a collaborative project funding Branko and Alexander, who actually work in Skopje at St. Cyril and Methodius University. This is the same slide as yesterday, same excuse as yesterday. I'm going to talk about speech production, not hearing, but what's going on here is Annelise Giraud is saying that we assume that the hearing system evolved at the same time as the speech production system, and one can assume that they've evolved to best match each other. So from an engineering point of view, we're assuming it's all a matched filter. And so the first part, the cartoon's to amuse the German speakers here. thank you for being amused. So the previous stuff I talked about yesterday was in the context of a project that was really about a translation between various international languages. And then we moved on and said, okay, that's quite difficult. Let's just confine ourselves to Swiss languages. And but then Swiss languages are normally French, German, Italian, and Romansh. But then once you go to the German-speaking part of Switzerland, I think people would deny it's German at all. And the point is, if you ask yourself what distinguishes Swiss French from standard French, phonetically it's more or less the same language, but the prosody is different. So one can spot a Swiss speaker because they will intonate differently. This is the same slide as yesterday. I'll play the
speech synthesis and
say so
problem.
It's the same justification as yesterday. We don't want to improve speech synthesis. That more or less works. But what we do want to do, I'll get on to it. And this is where we're coming from in here. There was an acknowledgement to Pierre-Edouard's roommate on that original slide, and this was drawn by Pierre-Edouard's roommate. But the one's saying tu fais du ski ou du snowboard. And I won't try to read the German, but the idea is the device has translated it. And this would have some kind of contrastive emphasis on it. It's like, do you ski or do you snowboard? He's not saying, do you ski or snowboard? He's assuming that you do one or the other. And this is something that's conveyed by intonation, by prosody. So you'll remember the application from yesterday. This is the same slide as yesterday. I'll play it because you weren't here yesterday. The idea is, we've got the student Hui, who is Chinese, and he also speaks English, so this is what he sounds like in English.
I believe you touched on an important point there.
So it's a guy speaking English with a Chinese accent a little bit. And then what the system produces is this.
I believe you touched on an important point there.
So that's a synthetic voice that's been adapted to sound like Hui. And the key thing there is that Hui didn't actually speak any English at all to train that voice. He spoke Chinese, and we adapted this model over here to the speech synthesis. The thing that's new today is, so this is the same diagram, and we've added this this extra level at the top and saying, well, we've modified the recognition and synthesis paradigm to do the adaptation. But then you say, well, what's it missing? And what it's missing is the translation of intent, the translation of the things you might emphasize, the things you might try to distinguish. And these are carried in prosody. Prosody is sometimes called paralinguistics, and it's taken specifically to be duration, intonation, and energy. So I'm going through this quite quickly now I think about it, but never mind. I'll talk a little bit about how we go about modeling prosody and the model that we have. So this is what I've just said. Prosody is traditionally taken to be these three things: pitch, energy, and duration. Pitch and energy have the same. If you think about increasing the energy of something you say, if you emphasize it, it's mainly the subglottal pressure that does that, and increasing subglottal pressure will increase pitch as well. So various of these things are correlated. And then there's duration, which in this work we're only going to look at pitch. You'll see in some examples later that it's not enough. We do need to look at duration as well, but I'll try and motivate why we only look at pitch. It's suited to the model. So this is a slightly more detailed view of what's going on. This is, you know, from the point of view of the student that has to do it. The part on the left is a kind of traditional speech synthesis system. So we're going from text and a waveform through to the features. Again, this is what was talked about yesterday, and I guess what's going to get talked about more as this meeting goes on. And in the middle, we've got a statistical model, and then from the statistical model, you can resynthesize the same features. What Pierre-Edouard's done at the end there is said, okay, we need an extra model for the F0, being the pitch. And we're going to build a model that's suitable only for pitch, but that's suitable for tying into a resynthesis. And this is not a... This has been attempted before by many people, and I'll give you three examples. So one, which was done by Paul Taylor, is called Tilt. And Tilt is what you might call a surface model, in the sense that you can take a pitch contour like that, and this would be the contour that's extracted from a pitch tracking algorithm. And then you can modify that directly. He parameterized it in terms of these kind of duration, rise amplitude, fall amplitude. But nevertheless, if this is what they were using in phonetic arts, so Paul Taylor had a company called Phonetic Arts, and it was bought by Google, and everybody moved to the office in London. And they were doing some really smart things with this kind of thing. So you could, they had this great thing where they had a game with a football announcer, and he's going like, goal! And you could sort of grab these pitch contours and drag them around and make this guy say these things. And so it's quite powerful. Another one is called SFC. I forget what SFC stands for, but it's coming from Gerard Bailly. I'll say Bailly, but it's the wrong pronunciation. He's in Grenoble in France. And that's essentially a neural network that's predicting some sort of higher level prosodic contours. So these are the sorts of things that will produce. And you can see that they get quite complicated. So, and they're expressing some involved things. You've got these incredulous questions like, really? That's what that contour is expressing there. Or obvious fact, like, of course it is. The prosodic contours that you would associate with those linguistic concepts aren't immediately obvious, but he's got the neural network modeling those things. Modeling, I would go as far as to say modeling it again in a surface manner. The last one, and probably the most common one, is something called command response, which was done by Hiroya Fujisaki, who I think was a HeNeX PhD supervisor, is that right? Can you read it, Dolores?
That's Hungarian, that's a different one.
It's Hungarian,
I
okay.
Those names look Hungarian.
This is Czech, right?
Anyway, this is phrase and accent.
Why it does he write it in Czech?
I have no idea. I think it's just pulled out.
Inspired by you.
I know that. I don't think he speaks any Czech.
It's coming from Branko, but then it goes, Branko is Macedonian. So I just left it in there because I thought it was funny. It's obvious what it means. But the command response system is interesting because it's not a surface model. It goes into this, the idea of prosody coming from commands in a physiological sense. So we've got two types of commands here. There's a command which is an impulse. I'm not sure it's physiologically plausible because they're using an impulse response to model an entire phrase. And if you think... It's modeling subglottal pressure. It's modeling what he would call the pneumatic system, although it's got nothing to do with tires. No. And I'll get onto this. Well, the impulses are modeling this gradual decrease in energy that happens as you say something. But the important one is these step commands here. So the step commands are filtered, and they produce the little bits of emphasis, as you see here. Now, Hiroya Fujisaki is Japanese. It was designed for Japanese. And it's designed that way because the Japanese have a particular way of talking where they'll say something, then it'll go a little higher, and then it'll drop down again. Then they'll emphasize something, and then they'll drop it again. And it doesn't really map onto English. However, those kinds of emphasis, if you just make them smaller, They do match the concept of, say, lexical stress, which happens in English, reasonably well. And it works well because it's filtered. So what I'm going to talk about is related to this model. But to do this, I'll talk a little bit about physiology, which does bring us closer to the new the reason for this meeting, which is about the way humans function. And the person that really got closest to this was a guy called Strick, Helmer Strick. He did his PhD in this kind of area. And he identified these four sources of pitch. Well, okay, the source of pitch is the glottal fold, Yes, the glottal folds, but there are various mechanisms that will change it. So there's really cricothyroid, which rotates the thyroid. There's the vocalis, which is let me go on to the. There are these four things, and I will show you pictures of them. So this is a cutout of somebody's throat here, clearly, and this is the vocal folds, and. I think this is animated. Yeah. So, what is the cricothyroid, which is a very small muscle in the larynx here? And I'll show you what it does in a minute. One is the vocalis, and the vocalis is stretched along the length of the vocal folds. So, as it contracts, it will make the vocal folds shorter, but also stiffer, so the pitch goes up. One is subglottal pressure. So this is the amount by which your lungs are forcing air through the larynx. The higher the energy, the increase in pitch. And then the last one is the sternohyoid, which is this long one here, which sort of tilts part of the larynx. I may have got that right. There's a sternohyoid and a sternothyroid, and I lose what these muscles actually are. But it doesn't really matter in the sense that, okay, you can see what this type of study has, a lot of these diagrams like this, where you can see this sternohyoid. It as it contracts, it's going to tilt this part of the larynx forwards, and it has the effect of stretching the vocal cords. Where are we going next? Yeah, exactly. So the sternohyoid is this long one here that will tilt the whole thing. And then the cricothyroid has the opposite effect. So what you do tend to find is people are used to like biceps and triceps, which clearly do opposite things here. And the same thing goes on in the larynx. I don't have a good understanding of this, but what I mean to convey is this sort of thing. And I think this is coming from Strick again. What he's saying is that if you imagine this sort of global component being the pitch or the energy with which you would utter something given a finite amount of air in the lungs, it would gradually fall off. And then what those muscles serve to do is modulate the pitch on top of that global component. And one key is there are models. So Fujisaki's original model only catered for increases in pitch. But in practice, there's this other muscle, which is the sternohyoid, I guess, which leads to decreases in pitch as well. That happens actively. So the result of this is we've got this active system where one can increase pitch and one can decrease pitch as one likes. But it's more or less one-dimensional. So there's something that increases and there are two things that decrease it. But it's not that complicated. It's certainly not as multidimensional as the phonetic system, the words, the phonemes. And that makes it quite interesting to study, because in extracting pitch, you can be reasonably sure you're getting quite close to the actual muscles that are doing the job. Or at least that's the hope. That's where we're trying to come from.
If all you care about is the pitch, then you're not modeling the voice and impressing this.
Yeah,
it really is just a one-dimensional problem. These muscles matter.
I think it matters in that I can make that claim that the pitch is directly mapping onto a given muscle. And then what I'm going to introduce is a model that's based on muscles, a very simple one. So it matters in the sense that there's that direct connection, but I don't think it matters in that I'm certainly not going to sort of go back and say, okay, well, this is clearly the cricothyroid moving in this way. I'm not going to make a strong connection like that.
Do you also model, do you also take into account the, say, onset and offset of intonation? So like the transitions from harmonic to noisy in the back?
That?
Because for that you would also need the postricus, the opening muscle.
So we don't. I'll get onto it, but we use the same pitch track. Well, actually for this we use the Caldi pitch tracker because it works a little bit better and it does what we want. But let me talk, and if I don't answer it in the next few slides, then shout, please. So what a lot of this is based on is if you look in any physiology book, you'll see a diagram rather like this. So it seems to be accepted that one has a spike coming in on a nerve, and it's an impulse. This is the measurement that you get out of it, which has some filter inherent in the measurement, but it's more or less an impulse. We assume that. And what comes out of this is a muscle twitch, which has this sort of steep rise and then a sort of exponential decay there. And the hypothesis that underlies all of what I'm going to say is that the movements of muscles can be broken down into atoms like this. It's a hypothesis. If I were to give this talk to physiologists, I'm sure I would be shouted down. But it functions as an investigation into whether this type of modeling can get you anywhere. And so this is the basis on which I'm going to talk. And it's we found out later on, you know, you start with a hypothesis, and then after 3 years, the PhD student says, "Oh, okay, I found this work, which, you know, we should have started with." And that work is by a guy called Régéon Plamondon, who used a model like this a while back, but for bigger muscles and for handwriting recognition. So it's interesting that, you know, it translates to that kind of thing. Plamondon used a log normal. So a log normal is a statistical distribution, but it looks a bit like this. What we've done is used a gamma distribution, but not because it's a statistical distribution. A gamma distribution is what you get if you assume that muscles are like car suspension. So this is the same diagram I put up yesterday. Yesterday I was using it to describe the glottal flow through one pitch period. Here I'm using it to describe what happens to a muscle when you ping it with a muscular twitch. So this is the impulse response of a critically damped second order system. And it has this gamma form. So it looks more or less like the diagram I showed before. Now, the nice thing about this stuff is, and in fact, it was the getting to know this algorithm that made us realize we could do something like this, is you can use something called matching pursuit. Matching pursuit is coming from Malat, who I think is the wavelet guy. And it's quite old now, but this paper's quite well cited. And I won't explain how it works in total, but it's a dictionary-based learning scheme. So what you have is a dictionary of wavelets, in his case. Here we've got a dictionary of muscle atoms. It represents a grid search over the parameters. We're saying, well, you know, we don't know what the muscle is, but here's a bunch of things that might constitute these muscles. And it gradually explains a contour in terms of these atoms. So what Malat was pushing is the fact that it's a compromise between a DFT, which uses these infinitely long sinusoids, and wavelets, where the high frequency ones have to be small. So you can have something that's ostensibly high frequency but also quite large. And it'll explain something to arbitrary accuracy. And care of Branko, I've got some animations that show you how to do this. So what's going on here is the waveform is there, but the waveform is just illustrative. This is actually log F0 and time. And the green spots are the pitch measurements, and the black line is the interpolation of that to cover the fact that what you said, we don't always vocalize. And the first thing that gets fitted is the global contour. So this is somebody gradually running out of breath here. And this one I don't want to dwell on. But what then happens is, okay, I have to push the button. Gradually, the system will explain fluctuations of this contour in terms of these atoms, which are hypothesized muscular responses. And after a few atoms, you will get a contour. Okay, it's flying by itself now.
Where do these come from, all these different peaks and troughs now, as the timing? You showed this, the lower graph.
Yeah.
These gamma functions?
They're from a dictionary. So a priori, we specify that, okay, here's a dictionary of different gamma functions that you can use. And then the algorithm is iteratively choosing the best one in the best position to explain the most error in this signal.
So how much do you lose by it being reading the algorithm and not finding the global optimum?
That's a good question. There is a non-greedy variant of this, which the guys in Skopje tried, and it didn't make a blind bit of difference. So I'm inclined to say we don't lose anything, but that's still an issue. It's a greedy algorithm. It's not a global one. What happened there? I think that's just so. It fits with arbitrary accuracy. But what I want to show you is a couple of things. One is there's a problem where it's used a lot of atoms here to fit something that doesn't exist at the beginning. So we need to say which ones do we keep. And the second one is it's used some very small atoms there which didn't make very much difference, and these are probably inaudible. So how do we identify those? And the one of the first things we managed to contribute in this is it's possible to replace the measures used in matching pursuit with perceptual measures. And there are really two sort of perceptual add-ons that we can make. So this is more or less root mean square. But what we've got there is a weight. And the weight here is the harmonic to noise ratio that I described yesterday. It's our belief about whether the system is being voiced or not. So the point is, if we know that something is being voiced, we add a strong weight. If we know that something is unvoiced, then we set the weight to zero. The other thing we can do is we can change from RMS to this thing called weighted correlation, which was introduced by Hermes, who is more of a sort of perceptual linguist. I mean, it's coming from that field. So we can go from something that makes sense in an engineering sense to something that makes more sense in a perceptual sense. And what happens there, and I think, is this going to play? Yeah, that plays itself. The first thing that happens is the weighting will stop it fitting things where there is really no voicing. So it solves that first problem. So you can see there, there were some atoms on the original slide, and that's managed to get rid of those things. So it leaves this difficulty of the small ones. And again, here, we can look at perceptual studies that have been done. And that's a kind of textual slide, but what it's saying is you can go to this paper by, there was Hermes and also this chap called Hart, who they've measured what the smallest differences that people can perceive are. And the ST is semitones, so it seems that men can't distinguish below about 0.1 semitone, and women a little better. And then, when you put this in the context of communication, you can widen these quite a lot. And Hart was saying that anything above 3 semitones is not anything less than 3 semitones isn't meaningful for conveying a message. And this is getting close to the thing we need. What comes of this, and this is coming from Hermes, is you can define these categories in terms of, so he's done it in terms of RMS, but also in terms of weighted correlation. And I think Hermes is pushing weighted correlation here. You can say there's category five, where you describe two sounds as completely different. And then at the other end, there's category one, where you really can't tell the difference between these sounds. And we have the numbers there. So those numbers will then plug it back into the matching pursuit algorithm to allow us to control the fitting. And what comes of that is we can now... So if you say apply the numbers that are appropriate for category one, which is absence of any perceptual differences, we've already pruned out a few atoms. There were 16 or 20 before. And then if you move through the categories, so go to category two, which is, here you're able to tell there's a difference, but there's no difference in the meaning. Well, now it's got rid of these small ones that we had before. And it goes on. So you've got category three, and four and five there. So, and what it's saying is, if you're prepared to put up with, here there is a linguistic difference. There is a difference in meaning, a difference in the meaning that we're conveying. But if we go back to category three, if you're prepared to put up with that, then you can actually describe an intonation contour with really very few parameters. And this is very nice. And you say, well, how many do we need? And you end up with a diagram like this. So what we did was, I think Pierre-Edouard put most of the Wall Street Journal corpus through the algorithm and said, how many, for a given weighted correlation, how many atoms do you tend to use? And what comes of, and if you plot it in terms of atoms per syllable, You get this curve, or it reminds me of one of these things that's clearly not a straight line, where somebody's drawn a straight line through it. But there is a definite curve there, and it has a definite sort of leveling out at one atom per syllable. So chances are what this model is doing is modeling syllables. Whether we intended it to do that is not clear. That just comes out of it, and what one can argue, I think I wrote later that it may be that we're modeling more than one muscle twitch.
One you could argue is that these events are not really physiological events, right? Because there's probably, you're maintaining tone throughout the whole utterance, right? So
yeah,
so it sounds like you've actually shown that there are pitch shifts every syllable. Is that?
Yeah, more or less. So yes, your intuition is right. There's a gap between the physiologically plausible model and actual physiology, and I certainly can't make a claim that this is describing the actual physiology. It's a model that's suitable to do that. If we could make those measurements, but it would be too strong a claim.
You watching the time?
Yeah, it's. I get close to the end, and it's. We've got 5 minutes or so. So in this last part, so we spent a couple of years with Pierre-Edouard and Branco and Alexander, sort of getting the model up and running and making it work. And in this last part, I'll just try to give you an example of some of the things you can do with this. And it's to do with transfer of emphasis. So remember, we're in the context of speech-to-speech translation, and we want to translate the fact that somebody is trying to convey meaning. So one idea was, okay, this is a sort of proof of principle. Can we take emphasis from an utterance from a word and transfer it to another word that wasn't originally emphasized. So that it's not clear that this is a useful thing to do, but it does show you what the model is capable of doing. And I can play you what happens here. So what we've got is three different utterances. The first one is a real utterance.
The matter seems to be somewhat confused.
So what she's been asked to emphasize the word somewhat, and she's done it in a slightly kind of, she's overdone it, and you can hear that emphasis there, as opposed to the neutral one, which is here.
Be somewhat confused.
Again.
The matter seems to be somewhat confused.
And the first one again.
The matter seems to be somewhat confused.
And the question is, what happens if you take the intonation from the first one and put it on the second one? And we can do that because we've got this model which has these components which are local to that word. And you end up with this.
The matter seems to be somewhat confused.
So it's a bit emphasized. The intonation changed, the energy didn't, and the duration didn't because we didn't try. So we clearly need to consider those to actually transfer emphasis. But the sense of being able to do that is there. So you say, can we build something that's a bit more useful? So instead of transferring from one word to the same word, can we build a model? And that was the end of, that's what Pierre-Edouard did towards the end of his thesis. So here we have a normal synthesis system, which has it has its own sense of prosody, and then we build on the side a model of emphatic words. So Pierre-Edouard was able to build a random forest, which is essentially a mirror of one of these decision trees that you use in speech recognition to choose phonemes. And that came up with a sort of reasonable way of, okay, here's a word, what would be the way to add emphasis to that? And in doing this, we can actually come up with hypotheses where we said, how do you do that? Is emphasis something that exists somehow on top of the normal prosodic process, or is it something separate? Is it something that you can, is it on top of the normal prosodic process, or is it part of the normal prosodic process? And that's to say, do we totally replace the prosody associated with an emphatic word, or do we add extra stuff to it? And Pierre-Edouard was able to answer that in, so this is the Mosher test that I used yesterday as a random sort of graph. Here it's an actual experiment, and we've synthesized some emphatic words and we've played them to people and we've got the results back. And without trying to explain the whole graph, what's going on is if in fact you add something, which is the one here, you get something that doesn't sound as emphatic as if you replace the prosody. And what that's saying is that prosody, emphasis, is a part of the normal prosodic process. You can't think of it as a separate process. And that's more or less all I want to say. I'll finish by saying this was part of a larger project with these Eastern European partners. So what we have is, although Milos Cernak is actually at IDIAP, he liked being on the project. Some of the other partners used this model to do some other stuff. So the people in Novi Sad looked at it in the context of TOBI, which is a prosodic markup scheme, and said, okay, yes, the atoms that it pulls out do seem to correlate quite well with what people would normally mark up as TOBI rises and falls. And then Georgi Sazak in Hungary used the same thing in a scheme that was detecting emphasis, which of course is part of the process, but it's not something we looked at IDIAP. And then Pierre-Edouard and Milos looked at a a different way of detecting emphasis. Actually, it was Milosh's work, but he was using this model again along with something else, and all of these appeared to work a little better because of a prosodic model. It's not complete. The muscle twitches are probably shorter than syllables. They're not much shorter, but you can certainly imagine that muscle twitches lead to Chinese tones, and Chinese tones would be a part of a syllable. They wouldn't be the whole thing. Although I can't think of anything right now which would a sort of prosodic element which would be shorter than a Chinese tone. We do need to look at pitch and energy in tandem. They're not independent at all. And also, we don't have a great model of the muscle. We started off with second order responses. There's a number that you can change, and if you change it to sixth order, it works better. So all the stuff that I showed you, I think, was using sixth order. We don't have a persuasive reason to do that. And Branko did actually do some work analyzing what muscle responses should look like, and he showed that muscles are a good deal more complicated than we assumed. But we don't have a good reason to choose any given model. But on the sort of positive conclusion, we can do this modeling. We can argue that it's physiologically plausible. We certainly can't say that it, I mean, related to your question before, we can't say it's the actual mechanism. The things we extract are local, so we can move them around, we can transplant emphasis, and it's possible to test some rudimentary hypothesis about the generation mechanism. I don't think it's possible to test strong hypotheses, but rudimentary ones anyway. I'll stop there. And it is 1:45, so I'm happy to take questions.
Really quick question. Is this really a restricted human language? Because I feel like animals actually have a certain amount of prosody. You know, you can tell when a dog is angry or happy. And so.
I really never thought about that, but my suspicion is that your intuition is correct.
For instance, with the Chinese tonal synthesis, that's presumably linguistic, right? You control that because you're, you want to create a particular pattern just for language, but the sort of emotional input into your speech is going to be, it seems like it would be sort of coming from a slightly different system or something. Is it?
I'd say the animal, in the case of a dog, I imagine they're using sort of longer prosodic.
Right. There can be a syllable by syllable basis. It may not be quite so. They may be so as sophisticated, but there may be a similar kind of underlying mechanism that's a little bit separate from.
Whereas dogs, that it has to do with the lips, more so, like how they, whether it's the growl with a closed lip or.
And there's a facial expression that goes with it.
Yeah, possibly that too.
There's more going on than dogs.
But I'm not an expert on dogs. No.
Yeah.
Birds. I don't know.
Cool. Thank you.